This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll talk with the legendary Johnny Rivers, the former Johnny Ramostella. He grew up on Convention Street in Baton Rouge and hit it big in the 1960s in Hollywood and beyond with 8 top 10 singles, including number one, Poor Side of Town, in 1966. He returns to a side of town he's familiar with, Government Street. Baton Rouge High will be host to the incomparable Johnny Rivers come Saturday. Also on the show, Rich Cohen, Tulane graduate. His book is Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. The Bears won the Super Bowl in New Orleans in 1986, January, against the New England Patriots. And we'll talk with Cindy Ruggio, who heads Lasers, about the state employees' retirement system. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is the incomparable Johnny Rivers, returning to his homeland Saturday for a performance at his former school, Baton Rouge High. He was involved in the renovation and the new auditorium, and that's where he'll be come Saturday. Hello, Johnny Rivers.
Hello there, Jim. How you doing?
Doing well. You like coming back to your old stomping
grounds? This will be my third time in that auditorium. I hope they didn't change it up too much because I really love the vibe in that old auditorium, and it had great acoustics.
What do you remember about your days when you were a young man there?
Well, I got to tell you something. My most memorable memory of that auditorium there was in 1954. There was a country music show that came to town there, and so Minnie Pearl was the host, and little Jimmy Dickens was on it, and this and that. So my buddy and I, my friend Dewey and I, decided to go see the country music show. We were just kids. So we go in there, and we're sitting in there, and in the middle of the show, Minnie Pearl comes out, and she says, "And now we have a special guest, this new sensation from Memphis, Tennessee, singing his new record on Sun Records, Elvis Presley." And out comes Elvis with Scotty and Bill on stage, and he's kind of jumping around there trying to set up. And the people around us started laughing like he was like a clown act or something. And we're looking like, what's going on? So then he goes, "And I'd like to sing my new record on Sun Records." And he starts, "Well, that's all right, Mama." And my buddy and I look at each other. We go, "Hell, that's that record we really liked from the radio," because they had already been playing it on the radio there. So anyhow, we got to see Elvis sing "That's All Right, Mama" and "Blue Moon of Kentucky." He did two songs. And then afterwards, we went around the back of the auditorium there, and they were loading up. The country guys had a big bus, you know, that they were traveling in. And then Elvis had like a 54 Cadillac Coupe de Ville pulling a little trailer behind it. And they were putting Bill Black's bass in there and Scotty's amp. And they were standing around there just, he was talking to some of the other country guys about cars. And I remember standing there looking at him going, "This guy is really cool."
You must have been, about 11 years old at the time?
No, I was a little older than that. I was probably about, 13 or something
okay.
like that.
All
but
right.
That made a big impression on me, of course, and then Elvis hit really big. And, and at that time, I was just starting to play guitar and, getting into it. And Fats Domino was around at the time and all those great New Orleans artists and stuff. I remember seeing Fats out at a hangar near the Baton Rouge Airport. And I went out to work my way up to the bandstand. And he comes out, he has band on stage, and he sits down at this piano, hits a chord, and he goes, "When Whippoorwill Calls," he starts playing "My Blue Heaven." And that was like a number one record at the time. And I'm going, boy, I love Fats. So I collected all his records and learned all his songs. 1957, I formed my own band, the Spades. And that's kind of how I got started. And I recorded a record at that time and down in New Orleans at Cosmo Studio with the same band that Fats and Little Richard and all those guys used.
You went to California, and as they say, the rest is history. You encountered Elvis later in your career, didn't
well,
you?
Well, yeah, out here in California. Yeah, I actually became friends with him. I used to go up to his house, and he was living out here. He was doing those little cheapy movies down in the early 60s, and we'd go up there and play music at night. He'd stay up really late, and he hated getting up early in the morning because he liked to stay up and hang out. My first time I came to California was after my record got some airplay around South Louisiana and Baton Rouge and stuff. We got a big write-up in the newspaper, the L.A., State Times, it was called. And Merle Kilgore invited us to come up and do two songs on the Louisiana Hayride in Shreveport. And that's where I met James Burton, who at the time was playing guitar for Ricky Nelson. And Elvis was in the Army, so Ricky was the hot guy, and
right.
He was singing his new records on, at tagging him on the end of the Ozzy and Harriet show. You know, it was actually the first music videos. I mean, Ozzy Nelson was pretty sharp realizing the power of television to sell records. That was way before MTV or any of that stuff, and so Ricky was really on fire. But anyhow, I wrote a song that I told James about it. Merle Kilgore introduced me to James Burton, who was standing backstage there after we did our two songs. And he said, "How'd you like to meet Ricky Nelson's guitar player?" I said, "Wow, James Burton, I really like his playing." So he introduced me to him, and I'd written this song. So James said he was staying at his mom's house here in Shreveport, and he said, "Why don't you send me the song, and I'll take it back out to California with me." And so I did. I ran to the radio station down in Baton Rouge. My buddy let me use their tape recorder, and I did a little tape of this song I had written, and I mailed it up to James at his mother's house up there with my phone number on it. And I never thought I'd hear anything else about it, you know, but about a month or 6 weeks later, the phone rang, and my mom answered. She says, "Hey, some guy says he's calling from Hollywood." I go, "Oh, yeah, sure." I thought it was one of the guys in my band who's playing a joke or something. So I got on the phone, and he says, "It's James." I said, "James?" He goes, "Yeah, James Burton." He goes, "You know that song you sent me?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I played it for Ricky Nelson. He really likes it. He's going to record it." And I went, "You're kidding," because that was a big deal back then. So I saved up some money and did a bunch of gigs and hopped a plane and came to California, to L.A., the first time to hang out with James and Ricky Nelson and stuff. So, and that was 1958.
You'd been living on Convention Street.
I was on Convention Street, yeah. And then I, you know, came out here for about 2 weeks, you know, and I kind of got the California bug. And I came back out here in the early 60s after going to New York and Nashville and all around and back to Baton Rouge and playing around with my band. And
the 60s were very good to Johnny Rivers. Turbulent time in our country. You wrote Poor Side of Town when you were living where?
Here in L.A.
In Beverly Hills?
I was actually
Hills?
Living in Beverly Hills. It wasn't exactly the poor side of town. But, you know, it was a good song, and it was one of my big records.
Number one.
The first time we used, you know, big orchestration strings and, you know, big background singers. Prior to that, I was just doing blues stuff and live. Well, you know, I got what really got me started was I opened the original Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Boulevard here on opening night. And as a matter of fact, the reason they even opened it was because I agreed to sign with them. I was playing at another place, and we had built up a big local following, and people were dancing. So one of the guys that eventually became the owner of the Whiskey A Go-Go, Elmer Valentine, approached me on the concept of it, and I said, "Well, what kind of name is that?" He said, "Well, you know, in Paris, France, there's a, I just got back from a vacation over in Europe, and he said, in Paris, France, there's a little club there. It's the hottest thing in Paris, and they play records and people dance, and it's called a discotheque." And I said, "Well, whatever." But he said, "You know, if you'll sign with us for a year, we want to build a cage, and we'll have these girls playing records in between your sets." And they became, they eventually became the Go-Go Girls. But when we opened the opening night, it was a smash. I mean, because I brought my following up from this other place, and it was packed with movie stars and this and that. And, you know, when then we recorded that live album there, and Memphis was a single out of it, and it became a number one record. And we did several live albums.
Yeah, didn't at one point, didn't the Doors open for you?
I don't know if they opened for me. The Doors, at the time I played for the at the Whiskey, the Doors were playing up the street at a little club called the London Fog. And their whole goal in life was to work their way up to where they could eventually play at the Whiskey. After I had some hit records, Elmer let me out of my contract there so I could go on the road, you know, and do concerts and stuff around the country. And then the Doors kind of slipped in there. But Jimi Hendrix played there prior to that, the Buffalo Springfield, Hugh Masekela. My off-night player was a guy named J.J. Cale, who wrote
Wow.
After Midnight and Crazy Mall songs for Eric Clapton. And then Dobie Gray also played as an off-night guy, you know, Give Me the Beat Boys and Free My Soul and Want to Get Lost in Your Rock and Roll. And on and on. I mean, and then Three Dog Night came in there, and Steppenwolf, and The Byrds, of course, and Frank Zappa. I mean, the list is endless. And then the Motown act started playing there as well. So,
you like all kinds of music.
Yeah, but my roots are the South Louisiana blues. You know, I mean, that's still the roots of my music. And that's what we're doing now. You know, I'm actually, I'm leaving tomorrow on Thursday. I'm going to be over in, Reserve, Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, and at the Riverside Academy. And we, me and Deacon John Moore are doing a music in schools program with the kids there and stuff, you know. So we go around and we go to these schools, and then I'm doing one showed up in Baton Rouge the next day at McKinley High School.
Excellent.
With Herman Jackson. So, you know, I have a foundation, and one of the things we want to do is pass on, you know, what we've learned, the original American music like blues and jazz, although I'm not a jazz player, but country music and bluegrass, anything that originated in the United States, rock and roll, of course. But the roots of all of that is blues, and the blues started in New Orleans. That's the cradle of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, New Orleans, Memphis, you know, and that kind of thing, St. Louis, all along the Mississippi there. And so, you know, that's the main thing we want to teach the kids is the basic roots of music is once you learn the blues, then you can go on from there. Everything else is just a variation of that.
You once said that you thought Secret Agent Man was your signature song. Rush Limbaugh certainly made it more famous than it already was.
Well, it's been in a bunch of movies. You know, it was originally a theme for a television show called Danger Man with Patrick McGoohan back in the 60s. And then we got a lot of calls to put it out. We went in and re-recorded it again and put it out, and it was a hit record. And then it got in a bunch of movies. The first big one was Austin Powers, and it was in Bowfinger with Steve Martin and Eddie Murphy, and then Jackie Chan's movie, The Spy Next Door. And then it's been several huge commercials on TV, Walmart, Chase Bank, Pepsi, on and on. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really big song for us.
Did you know Lou Reed?
No, I didn't. No.
Well, he, of course, was of the same vintage as you, and there aren't many.
But
there
the are music's more... totally different.
Of course.
The music and Lou Reed's like night and day. I knew of him, but I wasn't a big fan of that, you know,
that kind
Walk
of music.
On the Wild Side or wherever that stuff was.
You knew Glenn Campbell. And...
Very well. As a matter of fact, I'm the one that gave Glenn Campbell the song By the Time I Get to Phoenix. I had recorded it. First, I was working with Jimmy Webb. And I knew it was a hit song, and we had put out Baby, I Need Your Lovin' as a follow-up to Poor Side of Town. And so Glenn had just come off of Gentle on My Mind, which mm-hmm. was a semi-hit for him. So I called his producer and had him come down to, we had a little office over at Liberty Records there, and I played him my test pressing of my album that had Poor Side of Town. It also had By the Time I Get to Phoenix. And I said, I think this would be a good record, a good song for Glenn. So about 2 weeks later, I hear Glenn Campbell's version on the radio, which is an exact copy of mine.
It was a very good song.
And then he and Jimmy Webb got together, and they did Wichita Lineman and Galveston and a bunch of those. You know, it was great.
How did you discover the Fifth Dimension?
I started Soul City Records, and this guy, Mark Gordon, who was their manager, brought them over to me, and they were called the Versatiles. And we changed their name to the Fifth Dimension, and I hooked them up with Jimmy Webb, and I went in and produced their first album, Up, Up, and Away, with this Broadway play song that Jimmy had written, which at the time was total left field because it was kind of jazz and poppy, and you know, it cut right through all the folk rock stuff, you know, the mamas and papas and the this and the that. And it became Record of the Year and Song of the Year. We won 7 Grammys with that thing.
Well, for those who have not seen Johnny Rivers, he puts everything he has into his performances, and you'll be back where it all began Saturday night. You really enjoy performing.
Well, yeah, especially, you know, for audiences that really understand the music and, you know, which the people around Baton Rouge and South Louisiana definitely do. They understand the roots of it, you know. And, I don't just go up there and play blues. I mean, a lot of my songs are blues-oriented, like Memphis, the Chuck Berry tune, and Maybelline, and Mountain of Love is a real blues song. And, of course, Midnight Special was written by Leadbelly originally, and on and on, you know. So, but, you know, we've got, and I did a couple of Motown things. I did Baby, I Need Your Lovin', and Tracks of My Tears,
certainly.
Stuff like that, and,
well, Johnny Rivers has, John Fred once commented that when he saw you perform, he said, my goodness, it was just one hit after another, and it's quite a compilation.
Well, yeah, I remember John Fred really well, and we all started out about the same time back there in the 50s. John Fred and the Playboys, they were a great group, and Jimmy Clanton was playing around, and Van Broussard, and Dick Holler, and the Dukes of Blues and with Cy Holly, you know, and Dick Holler was around Baton Rouge. He wrote Abraham, Martin, and John for Dion.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, Johnny, have a good trip home. We'll see you Saturday night.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
All right,
our pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Take care. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757, Inkstershow at WRKF.org, if you'd like to reach us by email. Rich Cohen, a New York Times bestselling author, grew up on the north side of Chicago, and he was a big fan as a young man, as you might imagine, of the Chicago Bears. He's written 10 books and a host of magazine articles for, among others, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's Magazine, and Vanity Fair, where he is a contributing editor. He's a graduate of Tulane University, making his second appearance on the show, and he goes back to his youth with his latest work, Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. Good morning, Rich Cohen.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, Rich. Now, you followed the Bears as a young man, and in 1985, there was no team better, perhaps in the history of the National Football League, than the Chicago Bears, led by Walter Payton and Jim McMahon. It culminated in New Orleans, a city you know well. This must have been a fun book to compose.
Yeah, I mean, that was, if you're from Chicago, you're used to losing. You know, I saw a guy with a T-shirt on once that said Chicago Cubs World Champs, and in little letters it said 1908. So, and in 1984, the Chicago Cubs were a great team and collapsed in the playoffs against the San Diego Padres. And then in 1985, the Bears came around. Not only did they win, but they completely annihilated opponents. You know, they didn't, in the playoffs that year, they didn't give up a single point. And they were like Mike Tyson. You know, they would, you watch Mike Tyson come into the ring, people just didn't want to be there with him. And that was like the 1985 Bears. He'd come onto the field and the game was over before it even began. And it was just, for a Chicago fan, it was like finally and excellent. And it was, to me, those guys were really heroes when I was a kid. I met them. I went to the Super Bowl. It's probably why I went to Tulane. And, you know, going to Pat O'Brien's, I got to actually meet Jim McMahon and Steve McMichael and Dan Hampton, all those guys hanging out drinking Hurricanes. And that was the last time I saw them, in January 1986. And the next time I saw them was, you know, in 2013 in Arizona and Chicago, you know, the whole life between those two meetings.
I remember the film critic Gene Siskel saying that the Bears won the Super Bowl title on his 40th birthday, and it was a lopsided victory over the New England Patriots. And that team at that time was as good as any in the history of the game. Why did the Bears not sustain this? Why did they not repeat and win other titles?
Well, you know, I almost thought at some point I should put a list together for businesses of how not to continue to run a business after success, you know, based on what happened with the Bears. They immediately started taking the pieces apart. So before the Super Bowl even, it was known that Buddy Ryan, who was the defensive coach and the guru, you know, Rob Ryan's now the defensive coach of the Saints, I guess. Buddy Ryan was the defensive coach for that team. He invented the 46 defense, which became unstoppable. He left. Before even the Super Bowl, they knew he was going to go take over the Eagles. Then very soon after, they started to lose pieces. Their great wide receiver, Willie Gault, left, went to the Rams, I think, or the Raiders. Otis Wilson, their linebacker, left. Wilbur Marshall, who was, you know, one of the greatest linebackers ever to play for the Bears, left when he was 26 years old. And then probably the most devastating thing was Jim McMahon. In 1986, in a game against the Green Bay Packers, a guy named Charles Martin, about 3 seconds after the whistle blew, picked McMahon up and drove him into his shoulder. And he basically missed the rest of the season. And his career was never really the same. He destroyed his shoulder. It was a violent, vicious late hit. The guy was suspended for a year. And, you know, the thing about the Bears was, you say that they were perhaps the greatest ever. In my mind, there's no doubt they were the greatest defense ever. I've never seen a defense, even the great Steelers defenses, they didn't do that to teams. But what they were always weak on was offense. You know, Walter Payton was coming to the end of his career. He was older by then, and the thing that made that offense go was Jim McMahon basically changing and audibling away from Mike Ditka's game plan. So Mike Ditka would call this very conservative running offense, and then if McMahon saw something, he would call an audible and throw a 50-yard touchdown pass. Without McMahon, it just didn't work. And they would bring in different pieces like Doug Flutie or, you know, eventually Jim Harbaugh to try to win with them, but they really never had a quarterback after McMahon. And also, one other thing is, everyone I talked to about Ditka is, even the players were kind of scared of Ditka. You know, Ditka from New Orleans, he came thereafter. And Ditka broke quarterbacks psychologically. Mike Tomczak, who was a quarterback for the Bears, actually had to go to a psychiatrist after dealing with Ditka. and quarterbacks, you know, ride on their sense of self-esteem. And the thing about Jim McMahon is he was such a nut and such a flake, he did not care. So Ditka would yell at him, scream at him, give him the business, call him whatever he'd call him, and McMahon would just flip him off and walk away and go back out on the field and do the same thing again. And that was really the element that made the whole thing work. And the other thing is when McMahon was playing, the players believed they could win any game because he would come back. And the defense played better when McMahon was playing, and McMahon kept the defense off the field and let them rest. Once he was gone, the whole thing, they still were the best defense in football for several years, but the offense just couldn't supply the points to go with the defense.
You were, what, 17 years old when the Bears won it all? And,
yep.
And you said that it had a lot to do with you going to Tulane. How did that happen?
Well, basically, by a complete fluke, my father got two tickets. Somebody gave my father two tickets to the Super Bowl. He couldn't go. He was working. And he gave them to me because he knew I was so crazy about the Bears. But all the flights were booked, and all the trains were booked. And I found out there was a charter plane full of Bears super fans, basically drunken adults, as far as I could tell, with giant mustaches all heading down. And I found out I can get a couple seats on that, but it meant missing a bunch of school. And I convinced my mother that I was actually going to go down and visit Tulane, that it would be a college visit. And that while I was there, I would just stop by the Super Bowl. And actually, I went down there, and it was so great. I mean, if you go to New Orleans from Chicago in January, you never want to go back to Chicago. You know, so I went down there, and I had such a great time that I basically just stayed down there for many years.
Now, the book follows the characters of the Bears, and believe me, there were some characters, a team of a great talent, immense talent on the field, but certainly some challenges that came after the championship season. Let's start with Walter Payton. Some say the greatest running back ever, at least one of the top two or three. Died a very young man of liver disease. His life after the championship was not all that great, and he wasn't even that happy on the day the Bears won it all. Tell us about Walter Payton.
Well, I think everybody in their head, you know, has a fantasy of how they want things to go. And I think that Walter Payton, to me, was the greatest running back in the history of football, not just for how he ran the ball, but for the other things that he did. As a blocker and even as a pass thrower, he would play quarterback for the Bears on occasion, and he was their backup kicker. He did everything. And when he was young, he carried that team. And by the time the team got really great, he was at the end of his career. And I'm sure that he imagined that he would go to the Super Bowl and run for 220 yards and score four touchdowns and do the things he did when he was 26. But as it was, he didn't score in the Super Bowl. Almost everybody else scored, including the Fridge. McMahon ran for two touchdowns. And it's funny, when I talked to like Jim McMahon and Mike Ditka, they sort of said they didn't even realize Walter hadn't scored. I mean, they were focused on scoring points and winning the game, not who scored the points. And actually, the Bears' game plan was, the Patriots, who they played, their game plan was so key to stop Walter Payton that the Bears ended up using Walter more as a decoy that game. And this only came out later, you know, after the game, he basically locked himself in a closet and cried and refused to come out and wouldn't talk to the press. And he was humiliated and he was angry. And I just think it's such an emotional game. And a game like that for him, your whole life builds up to it, and then you wait for it, and you wait for it for 15 years, and it comes, and then it just like that, it's over. And it didn't happen the way you wanted it to happen. And when Walter retired a couple years after that, he had a hard time. Like, he had a hard time adjusting to regular life. And that came as a big shock to people. To me, it's not really a surprise because it's almost like I equate it to guys who I've interviewed, astronauts who get outside the Earth's atmosphere and then have to come back. And they have a hard time adjusting. It messes with their head for the rest of their life. I think when you're at the peak and the pinnacle of a football team and you've been playing football all your life and your whole life is geared towards that, and then it's over and you're alone, and there's no practice to go to and no one to tell you what to do, it's just, I would have impossible time adjusting to it, and almost everyone does. So the revelations about Walter Payton in the end were that he was kind of like just a human being like the rest of us. And he had trouble with painkillers and everything else. I interviewed one of the Bears, and he said, yeah, a lot of us get addicted to painkillers. You know why? Because we're in a lot of pain. You know, so, I mean, you get pummeled like a guy like Walter, a running back that plays 13 years without missing a game. And if you ever watch Walter Payton, the way he played was he would hit people. I mean, he would hit as much as he got hit. So he took an incredible amount of punishment, and he had a hard time after he retired. But what I thought when I was working on this book is here's a group of 40 guys, And it's almost like a sample, like in an anthropological study. If you follow them, you see every version of American experience. So you get Walter that died of this terrible liver disease, Dave Duerson, who was a great Notre Dame defensive back, and a couple years ago shot himself in the chest, if you remember, because he was suffering, he believed he was suffering from CTE, the disease you get from getting hit in the head, and he wanted his brain to be studied, so he shot himself in the chest. And then you get a guy like Gary Fencek, who was the team's great free safety, who went into private equity and made more money in business than he ever made on a football field, you know. Or you get Ron Rivera, who's coaching Carolina, or Jeff Fisher, who's coaching the Rams. I mean, you watch them lead their different lives, and it's amazing because it shows you everything.
Our guest is Rich Cohen, graduate of Tulane. His book is Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. And Rich is one of the most versatile writers in the world today. His first book was Tough Jews, a nonfiction account of Jewish gangsters of the 1930s in Brooklyn. Most recently, 2006, Sweet and Low, a memoir about the creation of the artificial sweetener, a product that was invented by Benjamin Eisenstadt, who is Rich's grandfather, correct?
Well, yeah, he's not alive anymore, but he was my grandfather, and right. I guess in some metaphysical sense he still is.
Well, sure. But this book is obviously about football and the men who play it and the Chicago Bears of 1985. Many of whom paraded through Tiger Stadium as collegians, like Willie Gault when he was at Tennessee, and also many of whom played against the New Orleans Saints, and of course Mike Ditka later coached the Saints. You say he was a mercurial fellow. Did the players fear him?
Some feared him, and some loved him. It's like this sort of. Just no one had no opinion of him, that's for sure. And the guy who became the general manager of the Saints, I believe, was Jim Finks.
Correct.
And Jim Finks had a great line about Ditka. He said his strategy, ready, fire, aim. And I sort of think that tells you everything you need to know about Ditka. He was a really great football player for the Bears. Something about him was pure Chicago. He was a disciplinarian. He was a hothead. He was... after the biggest game of the year, he got a DUI on the way home from the airport after beating the 49ers. I mean, it's kind of crazy stuff happened with Ditka. So I think that for that team of really talented players who were just on the verge of winning, he was the perfect coach. And also he was a great coach because he was with Buddy Ryan. And together, you know, Ditka was like the CEO and Buddy Ryan actually ran the defense. So for the Saints, to me, Ditka made no sense. It's like trying to grow a palm tree in Chicago. It just doesn't make any sense. He just really didn't belong in New Orleans, I don't think. But for that particular Bears team at that particular Bear time, there could not have been a better coach. And if you actually look at his record for his career as a coach, it's incredibly high winning percentage.
Yeah, he did a fantastic job with the Chicago Bears, who were not all that great before he took over. But they were great for a while and won it all in 1985. You remarked about Dave Duerson. Here's a guy who loved to hit people. He didn't like it when players didn't play as a result of injuries of certain kinds. And then he has the ultimate tragedy, dementia at an early age. When did he find out that he was literally losing his mind?
It seemed like it happened very quickly at... I don't think anyone's put an exact date on it. That's a weird thing about CTE and sort of the scary thing, which is the only way to diagnose it is in an autopsy. So in addition to actually maybe having this disease, there's the fear of do I have it and not being able to know. You know, so he was doing, very successful in business and very successful working with football players. And then at some point he just had trouble organizing his thoughts, and then he noticed a change and his family noticed changes in his mood, get angry. He just became like a different kind of guy. And he recognized at some level that that wasn't him. And then he started hearing about CTE and started feeling like he had those symptoms. And then he became so certain of it that he took his own life. And I interviewed Jim McMahon, and he said he saw Duerson like just a couple months before, and he seemed fine to him. You know, I mean, it was obviously something he was keeping completely to himself. But that's the scary thing about it, which is it's not like, you know, you do something to your shoulder, you do something to your knee, you get it diagnosed, you deal with it. It's You're not sure if you're going crazy or not in your own head. And everybody, I spoke to a guard named Kurt Becker, who was a great guard on that team, and he said he thinks they all have it. You know, that's his opinion. And he said, you know, the worst thing is you don't know if you're going to get the symptoms when. It's just like this thing hanging over their head. Especially now the rules are changing and hopefully things will get better, but that was a very, very violent era. And the Bears' strategy was sort of to knock out quarterbacks. That was how they played.
You mentioned McMahon. He's had his issues. Does he have some of the same problems that Dorsen had?
Well, he was part of the lawsuit, and there was a big Sports Illustrated article saying that he had these severe problems. I interviewed him, and he said he has short-term memory problems. And they gave him a test where showed him like 15 objects, and then asked him to name as many of those as he could, and he can only name three of them, which is not good. So, but to actually sit down and talk to him, if you're talking to him about stuff that happened 25 years ago, he remembers everything, you know? And he's an incredibly, incredibly great storyteller, and he's an incredibly fun guy to hang around with. So for me, it was like a thrill to sit with him and ask him everything I wanted to know when I was 17 but had no way to ask, and he was able to answer those questions. So I don't know the whole thing with CTE. I don't know if there's various degrees of it, but he did not seem angry, moody, or depressed. He had none of those symptoms as of now. He's still sort of the great guy he's always been, as far as I could tell.
Outside of Peyton, who do you think were the best players on that team?
Well, there were actually, five Hall of Famers, if you include Ditka. But Ditka was a Hall of Famer as a player.
Right.
So if you went by that way, you'd have to say Richard Dent, who was like a sixth or an eighth round draft pick. And the story with him is he was very skinny and light, and he had a problem with his teeth. And as part of his contract, his first contract, the Bears agreed to pay for his dental work. His teeth were fixed, and he immediately gained 50 pounds and became a terror, you know. Yeah. And so you'd have to put him there, and also Dan Hampton, who was a defensive tackle and a defensive end, and was an incredible force. But what was amazing about that team was almost entirely on defense, a Pro Bowl team. And if you go through them, almost every one of those guys is on a Pro Bowl at least once. So, you know, you had Dan Hampton, called the Danimal, but also Steve McMichael, they called him Mongo, and you had the Fridge, and then you had, you know, of course I'm forgetting Mike Singletary, another Hall of Famer, the great, great middle linebacker who really was the captain of the defense. And to me, everyone said that Lawrence Taylor was the greatest linebacker in the NFL. I just figured that was because he was in New York, where all the media was. But the truth is that the greatest linebacker in the NFL at that time was Mike Singletary. And then Wilbur Marshall and Otis Wilson, both Pro Bowlers. And, you know, Leslie Frazier, who is a great cornerback, now coaches the Vikings, got hurt in the Super Bowl. And Mike Richardson, who was a Pro Bowler. And then one of my favorite players, Gary Fensick, who played free safety and was an incredibly smart, a borderline Hall of Fame player, leads in all the Bears' career statistics. And he played beside, you know, Dave Duerson. In the offense, you have McMahon and Peyton, and it's just an incredibly, incredibly talented group of very young guys. At the time, the youngest team in the NFL.
And we'll talk more with the author of Monsters, Rich Cohen, the 1985 Chicago Bears, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. The guest for a bit longer is Rich Cohen, Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears, and the Wild Heart of Football. That is his book, and it is a rare football book that has a lot to do with the amazing characters that were members of this team. Bob Costas says, every year brings a Super Bowl, World Series, NBA, and Stanley Cup champion. Yeah, all are duly noted and celebrated, but a memorable few have greater and more lasting resonance, a standing that excellence alone cannot explain. The 1985 Chicago Bears were such a team, a melange of talents and outsized personalities that captivated and embodied a city. Rich Cohen experienced it as an obsessed 17-year-old. Almost three decades on, he remains obsessed, entertainingly and insightfully so, but obsessed nonetheless. His combination of reporting and remembrance is by turns evocative, revealing, quirky, and funny as hell, or at least funny as Gary Fensick doing the Super Bowl shuffle. And I remember the Super Bowl shuffle. That was certainly part of that team that's seared in the memory banks of anybody who was around, I think, in 1985.
Yeah, well, you know, it's amazing because I think they could only do that Super Bowl shuffle because there were so many characters on that team. And if you think about any professional team, there's usually one or two guys that stand out and speak for the team. And in the Bears, it was like complete chaos because there were like 15 guys like that. And then, of course, the Super Bowl shuffle then took what we knew about them in Chicago and branded them for the whole country. I always thought the Super Bowl shuffle, if I had to compare it to something, it would be like the introduction to the Brady Bunch or Gilligan's Island, like the song. Because the song tells you the whole story, and it becomes almost the theme song for the sitcom that was the 85 Bears. And that was a great thing about that team, which is it wasn't just for sports fans. You know, it was anybody. There was so much going on the sidelines. There were so many narrative lines. It's great for a writer, but great for, you know, my mom, who suddenly became interested in them, who didn't know anything about football, because you had all this stuff. You had, you know, George Halas had played for the Bears, owned the Bears, and started the NFL. He had famously stripped the ball from Jim Thorpe and run 99 yards for a touchdown in Wrigley Field. I mean, that's how far back it goes. George Halas, on his deathbed, brought back Mike Ditka, his tight end who'd got him his last title. And then Ditka brings in, you know, Jim McMahon, who he's constantly feuding with, and it becomes this great sidelight. There was a great moment in that season where the press said to Ditka, is it true you haven't spoken to your quarterback in 2 months? And he said, no, it's not true. I told him to shut up just the other day. So you had this all this incredible stuff. And even when you go to the games, you'd see them fighting and feuding on the sidelines. It was just a soap opera. It was just really fun.
But you say the person you were most excited to talk with was Gary Fensick.
Well, Fensick, I'm from, you know, North Shore of Chicago. And Fensick was, it's football, you see these guys, they're gigantic, you know, they're incredible athletes. And it's hard to sort of put yourself in their place because they're seem like completely different. Fensick was a guy like me, you know. He was from where I grew up. He went to a good high school. He was a good athlete, but not a great athlete. And the only reason he got recruited, he said, was there was a great quarterback on his high school football team, and all the colleges would watch film, and he was the one catching all the passes. So eventually, he got recruited, and he went to Yale of all places. He was one of the last guys drafted by the Miami Dolphins. He was the last guy cut by the Dolphins in 75 or 76. He'd taken a job with Citibank when the Bears called and said they knew he was a local kid and they always wanted local kids for fans to identify with, just like I did. And they said, as long as you're in town for a couple of days, you want to come by and try out. And he made the team, and within a year he was one of the best guys on the team, playing beside Doug Plank, known as the Hitmen. And they would just, you know, level guys. I spoke to Doug Plank, one of my favorite players, too, and he's number 46, named the 46 defense. And I asked him what makes a hitter, because he was a great hitter, and he said, lower your head and run into a brick wall. A normal person will slow down or brace at the last minute. A hitter will actually accelerate into the brick wall. As long as you can suppress your survival instincts for a moment, you can be a great hitter in the NFL.
Well, Fensick, he is at this stage, he appears to have dodged the problems that Dave Durison had. It's hard to fathom why some people have dementia and others don't.
I think it's like anything else, like alcoholism. You know, some people, they can drink and they're okay, and some people can't. I mean, it's something in your genes, I guess, that make you more susceptible to having a problem or showing symptoms, and it's just like a spin of the dice. And, you know, not only Fensick, a guy like Doug Plank, who he used to carry smelling salts in his waistband to revive himself. He used to knock himself out. He told me that he would stand up, and he couldn't remember anything, so he'd just look and see what color jersey he had on and go stand next to the guys in those jerseys. And this is a guy that probably got a concussion every time he played football, you know, and he's fine. And that's just the luck of the draw, I think, having to do with something that happened 2 million years ago with your ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rich Cohen, as I noted, is one of the most versatile writers in the world today. What's your next project, Rich?
I'm actually working on a story. This is like the talk about the greatest assignments of all time. I'm writing a story for Sports, for Vanity Fair about the 50th anniversary of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. So I'm hanging around with a lot of really good-looking women.
Cheryl Teagues and Christy Brinkley.
The first woman ever on the cover in like 1964 named Babette. She's now 72 and still looks great.
Well, good for you. That's something that is a good follow-up to Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. Last time you were on this show, I had a few emails after your appearance. they were amused about you growing the Hitler mustache.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
Now, you were right in the middle of that story when we had to roll. I'd like for you to expound on it just a bit. It's a fascinating story. It took a little bravery on your part, but you got quite a reaction, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I just had this idea. I was actually saw my editor from That Story last night. He said it was like the easiest pitch of all time. He just said to his boss, Rich wants to grow a Hitler mustache and see what happens. That was basically the story. And I just thought it's so crazy that just this one configuration of facial hair could make people go so insane. And I was curious about, you know, the history of the Hitler mustache, like who wore it before Hitler, does anybody wear it now, and sort of what happens if you just grow one and walk around, what will happen to you? Will people jump on you, attack you? And mostly people just acted like I was insane and tried to stay away from me, so it turned out not being as dangerous as I thought.
Well, Rich Cohen, congratulations on another fine work, and we look forward to talking with you about the Sports Illustrated anniversary as well.
Thank you. Excellent. Thanks for having me.
Take care, and it's a fine book from a versatile and talented writer, Rich Cohen, Monsters, the 1985 Chicago Bears, and the Wild Heart of Football. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest is Cindy Rougeau. She is the executive director of Blazers, and we're here to talk about retirement in Louisiana. The Louisiana State Employees Retirement System has seen a $714 million increase in the value of its assets over the last year or so. And Cindy Rougeau, the perception by many is that the retirement system is bankrupt. Is that the case?
Well, no, that's not the case, and I appreciate you bringing that up and giving me a few minutes of your time. With the bankruptcy that occurred in Detroit, we have received a lot of calls and inquiries about that, but I want to assure the taxpayers and, of course, our members that Blazers is doing very well. We're not going broke. We actually added $4 billion to our fund over a four-year period, and like you said, just over the last year, our assets have increased by nearly three-quarters of $1 billion, but what's also important is the debt has actually been reduced by about that same amount.
How many employees are there involved participating in the state employees retirement system?
What we have now is almost an equal number of active members and retirees, around 45,000, 46,000.
So that's an increase from a year ago?
No, sir. With the we've lost about 8,000 of our active members over the course of the past year, and so our active membership has been reduced substantially.
Okay, it has decreased by over 8,000. Why do you think that's the case? What has happened?
Well, that's a result of the layoffs of the various executive branch agencies, and it certainly at the time we didn't know what type of impact it was going to have on Blazers. It has had a financial impact on Blazers, but it's resulted in a positive financial impact because we're going to be paying fewer benefits going forward.
Well, the unfunded accrued liability was something that the governor referred to when he was making observations and offering suggestions on how to address this. How is that working? Is that going down?
Actually, it's gone down, like I said, by about $700 million just in the past fiscal year. And I think what many folks don't know is that it's on a statutorily created payment schedule, and those payments are being made. In fact, we've just now turned the corner, and the state is paying on principal and not just interest. And you know, Jim, you mentioned the push for pension reform, and that has been a huge issue. And I think what's too often lost in the discussion is the fact that Louisiana was actually on the leading edge of pension reform because we began pension reform in 2005 and 2010, and the reforms that were implemented at those times are actually going to save Blazers about $800 million. The types of reforms that other states are talking about now, just starting, we've already done.
How does Louisiana compare with other states in its unfunded accrued liability?
Well, Louisiana is different in many ways, such that we are one of only a handful of states who have a constitutional requirement that the debt be paid, and that the system be maintained actuarially sound. So Louisiana back in the late 80s showed a lot of fiscal responsibility. And so that sets us apart in a good way.
Well, this annual report that you are referring to, it has some encouraging news, but the long-term prognosis, how does it look as far as the stability of the retirement system?
I think the long-term prognosis is excellent. And, you know, I actually went back and looked at how we've done with cash flow over the past 10 years, and I found that we've brought in $11 billion and paid out $7 billion. So our cash flow in has been substantially over our cash flow out. And like I said, I think with having a constitutional protection and a statutorily set payment schedule for the debt, Louisiana is in good shape. And with the reforms that have been implemented, we're certainly on the right track.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, Cindy?
I sure would. I'd like to point out that recently Lasers was recognized as one of the top 10 performing retirement systems in the nation for the past decade, and we're very proud of that.
But lost over 8,000 members in the last year.
Yes, we did, and I do want to reassure our members that that did not jeopardize the soundness of the system or the benefits that we pay out to our retirees, because Lasers is not a pay-as-you-go system like Social Security. We are an actuarially funded system, meaning benefits are paid for as they are earned. So benefits are safe and the system is sound.
And you say it will save about $24 million in payment because of the adjustments.
Right. We're actually it's interesting, the debt has gone down, and the amount of money that the state is going to pay Lasers next year in employer contribution will go down about $24 million. But as you know, Jim, the employer contribution rate is set as a percent of payroll. So as payroll shrinks, even with the dollar amount going down, the percent goes up. And state agencies will be dealing with that effect as long as the layoffs continue.
Well, Cindy Ruggio, always a pleasure, and good luck to you, and we look forward to getting an update again soon.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Take care. Mm-hmm. Bye. And we thank Cindy for joining us. We had been endeavoring to talk with her and got the chance, and she actually was pinch-hitting for Gary Pomeranz, the author about the book regarding the Pittsburgh Steelers. He could not be with us this morning, but maybe we'll talk with him down the line. As we started the show with Johnny Rivers, it's good to note that Zachary Richard, the original Cajun rocker, will be on stage with Johnny at 7:30 Saturday night at Baton Rouge High, and it should be quite a performance. Johnny Rivers will turn 71 years old 1 week from today, and he is still going strong. You can feel the energy when he talks, and when he sings, he's even better. And here's a sampling of how he sounded 47 years ago, his only number one. He had many top 10 hits, but his only number one, he wrote it, Poor Side of Town.
Tell me how much you missed me when the last time I saw you, you wouldn't even kiss me. That rich guy you've been seeing must have put you down. So welcome back, baby, to the poor side of town. To him, you were nothing but a little plaything. Not much more than an overnight fling. To me, you were the greatest thing this boy had ever found. And girl, it's hard to find nice things on the poor side of town.
Johnny Rivers, Saturday night at Baton Rouge High. The man who grew up in Baton Rouge is John Henry Ramostella. I got a caller ask about other hits in the top 10. Memphis was number 2 for Johnny Rivers. Secret Agent Man went to number 3. Seventh Son was number 7. Mountain of Love, number 9. And Tracks of My Tears was 10th. So a number of top 10 songs from the great Johnny Rivers. For J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. We thank you for listening today. Back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent...